Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, May 7th, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, understanding how the media prioritizes coverage and how the story of more than 250 teenage girls kidnapped in Nigeria didn't make headlines here for nearly a month after it happened. When tomorrow's issue of Vanity Fair hits newsstands, it'll have a piece penned by Monica Lewinsky. Why, after 17 years, she's breaking her silence now about her affair with President Bill Clinton. And the White House Correspondents' Dinner was held in Washington Saturday night. We'll discuss the ethics of reporters rubbing elbows with those they're supposed to be covering. There's a whole lot more that we'll hopefully get to as well, but let's start with a documentary that ran on most PBS stations, including KMOS here in mid-Missouri Monday night. Samantha Grant's film, A Fragile Trust, is a decade-long study of Jason Blair, his fabrication, his plagiarism, and the effect it had on the New York Times.
The Jason Blair debacle became shorthand for all of the shortcomings of the news business. Because it happened at the New York Times, because there were so many stories involved, this became an explosion.
It began as a reporting scandal and then quickly turned into a near mutiny by the staff.
The New York Times is calling it a huge black eye. Was the paper too eager to promote an appealing young black voice?
It became about race because a black person was involved. A black person cannot be involved in anything without it being about race.
Like all the stuff that gets fused in and becomes like this snowball that just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
He had better tips than the entire Washington Post because he was making it up.
We were dealing with a disturbed individual who was exhibiting sociopathic behavior.
I poured everything into journalism, and I would lose it all. And I was losing it all.
So that was the trailer to the documentary. You can see the full thing on PBS's website, too. It was part of the Independent Lens series. Now that we've had a chance to see it, what were some of your big takeaways?
Well, first of all, in some ways, to me, it was kind of sad and also a little bit boring to be revisiting all of this after all this time, because I'm not sure, though the documentary was well produced, that it really shed any light on anything we didn't already know, those of us who'd followed it, and maybe members of the public didn't follow it all that closely. The thing that kind of stuck with me, everybody who was interviewed, including Jason Blair, and that was quite a get for the filmmaker, but also Hal Raines, who was the executive editor at the time, and almost everybody else they interviewed seemed to be in butt-covering mode, if you really want to just put it bluntly. I mean, Blair still came off to me as, we know why he got away with what he did for so long, at least partly because the guy's a really good liar, and he's a really good manipulator of the facts, and it came across that way in the documentary, too.
Well, I just have to be transparent. I hadn't watched it yet. I have DVR'd it, so I do plan to watch it. But one of the things that really surprised me about it was how long he was able to get away with it before he was caught. And the fact that all the way back to his days in college, he had been – people had been basically saying that he's done these things. Mm-hmm. So at various internships across the country – he did this. He gets to the New York Times. He has mentors. They were told that there was some issues with his story, issues with his reporting, and no one seemed to want to deal with it until it actually blew up in their faces.
I mean, the bigger question, I suppose, and the filmmaker tried to address it, was what was going on within the New York Times newsroom and the culture there that might have allowed him to get away with it? And the one question that she really didn't answer all that clearly is, why didn't upper management deal with the memo from middle management that says he cannot write at the New York Times any longer? Hal Raines said, well, I never saw that memo. That's pretty unconvincing. And then they kind of let that question fall. The question they did address, and it's still controversial today, I suppose, is whether race or diversity or affirmative action or whatever label you want to put on it had something to do with it. And the filmmaker quotes, I mean, everybody she quotes in the film, whether it's mm-hmm. Jason Blair or Raines or a friend of his who was a reporter there at the time, even a young woman who was a reporter in San Antonio, the first person he was caught ripping off, all said no, that this wasn't about race or affirmative action. And I think maybe from their vantage point, that's probably true. But I still have to think that the way the New York Times was trying to deal with diversity, and a lot of critics say that, you know, their program was pretty shallow or bureaucratic, might arguably have had something to do with it as part of the larger problems within the newsroom.
Well, I know that the middle managers who sent that memo out, a lot of them specifically said that the only reason he was there was because of their diversity initiative. And at the time, you had some of those middle managers, as well as some of the top brass at the New York Times, basically saying we need to be able to bring more minorities into our newsroom so that we can basically show that we're covering a wide variety of subjects and a wide variety of people. And the newsroom just didn't have it. But I do agree with you to a certain extent, Mike, that part of the problem was that you didn't have someone who would just come out and say, yes, this is an issue, yes, this isn't a problem, and this is how we're going to deal with it. And I think if they had done that on the front end, they would have been able to, number one, deal with the Jason Blair issue as Jason Blair's issue and not it becoming a diversity initiative issue.
And whether that was a big part of it or not, for whatever reason, what the New York Times management did was pass the buck. They sent him from one unit to another rather than take up the problem. And one person it would have been really great to have heard from in this documentary that unfortunately, of course, we weren't going to get to hear from was Gerald Boyd, Mizzou alum who was the managing editor at the time. There were accusations that just because he was there and he was a black man, that somehow he was the mentor to Jason Blair. We don't really know
that was true.
But since he died from lung cancer several years ago, we'll never know what his take would be today.
So among the different excuses, if you will, that Jason Blair had given for the fabrications and the plagiarism that he engaged in, he did mention substance abuse, the alcoholism, and the use of cocaine. But he also blamed this on the frenetic pace at the New York Times and how quickly he was expected to churn out stories, one or two a day, sometimes eight a week. Looking at how the media landscape has changed since 2003, 2004, if he couldn't keep up then, was there any chance he'd be able to keep up now?
Well, I'm not necessarily sure that he was. I think a lot of that is his own fabrication in his own mind, okay, that he was expected to do all of that.
Okay.
There's no documentation that shows that editors were asking him to do this or expecting him to do this, especially if you're an up-and-coming journalist. They want to try to groom you, and you can't groom someone by basically having them just churn out story after story after story. So I think part of this is him giving an excuse. Now, to answer your question, in today's media environment, yeah, you have a lot of reporters who are expected to do that. Do the initial story that's going to go possibly on the website, mm-hmm. and then you turn around and do something for the print edition. Then you have to do a blog. So in today's environment, yes, you're expected to do that. And that's, it, to a certain extent, why you see a lot of shoddy reporting going on.
I mean, frankly, you know, once in a generation do you get somebody who's that good a liar in that kind of a circumstance. And I buy that he had substance abuse problems. That was documented. I'm even willing to accept the possibility that it was fueled by an undiagnosed mental health problem at the time. But to blame it on the pace, I mean, he could have done those stories as easily in as much time as he'd actually gone out and interviewed people as all the work he put into sitting in his apartment and stealing from other people.
Yeah, I think a lot of it had to do with his own laziness, and it had to do with the substance abuse problem and probably the mental health issues. I mean, there were reporters out there, including the reporter at the San Antonio Express mm-hmm. News, who were on the ground. There was a Washington Post reporter who was on the ground doing the same thing. The problem was he wanted to try to be a national reporter based in New York who never left New York. And you just can't do that.
Okay, well, about a month ago, the nation's attention was tuned into 24-hour news channels, CNN specifically, waiting for word about the missing Malaysian airplane. What happened to those 270-plus people who just fell from the radar? In mid-April, reports started to trickle out of Nigeria. 276 teenage girls were in school taking a test when they were kidnapped by armed men. A few dozen are said to have escaped, but their whereabouts and safety is not known. Till just a few days ago, that story, the one in Nigeria, was largely unreported here in the United States. Yesterday, as we were getting word of another 8 kidnappings, the Obama administration announced it would send the FBI in to help try and find those girls. This is a really big deal. How is it that word of it didn't really make it in the Western media or spread until now, weeks later?
Well, I think it's one of those, for lack of a better phrase, a perfect storm of an international story that's involving Africa. And when it comes to the mainstream media, the American mainstream media, we have cut back so much on international coverage that you run the risk of these things happening. And then you throw in the fact that it's happening in Africa, which is a country that we've never really covered much of. And that may, you know, some people may say that revolves around race. The fact that, you know, you're not talking about Europeans, you're not talking about whites, you're not talking about China, which has this explosion in terms of economics. You're talking about Africa, which is seen as a third world area. And you're talking about an issue that just does not resonate with an American audience until you see this explosion on social media. And now all of a sudden, the mainstream media is like, well, wait a minute, we got to pay attention now.
Because using that hashtag of bring back our girls.
Exactly, bring back our girls. And then they start looking at it, and then they start connecting it to the fact that you are talking about children, and you are talking about something heinous. And now all of a sudden, it starts to resonate when you pull back away from the fact that it's race, the fact that it is Africa, the fact that it is international, and start focusing in on the humanity of it or the tragedy of it, then all of a sudden it becomes a story.
I mean, I'll say it. It's partly about race. It's not all about that, but it's partly about race, both in terms of the journalists and the American public's appetite for the stories. But there's a lot of other things. And, you know, I think that Ernest mentioned many of them. There are the pullbacks in terms of international bureaus. There were other stories, and especially on cable TV news, there's a lot of focus on stories that are easier to get to, whether it was the ferry in South Korea or the missing plane. You are talking about, if you really want to tell that story visually in Nigeria, are you going to send reporters into the part of the country that's where, you know, Boko Haram is in control? It's a more difficult story to tell. But I still think that it's really shameful that it took the social media, people using basically Twitter, to get this story out there for American media and American politicians to finally pay attention.
But this isn't the first time this happened. I mean, there have been numerous stories over the last several years in which social media has been the one driving the bus. And race has been one of the issues involved in that. I mean, Trayvon Martin, the Trayvon Martin story basically exploded because of what was happening on social media, and then the mainstream media picked up on it. Now the local Florida media was on top
of again, it. Right, again, weeks after the fact.
But weeks after the fact, all of a sudden the national media comes into play. Here we go again, the same thing. So, Mike, I think you're right. I don't want to say that race is not playing a part here, because it's playing a huge part. But I also, one of the things that's really bothering me is that now all of a sudden you have a lot of people jumping on the Obama administration basically saying, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? When they aren't really thinking about the fact that this is a sovereign country. We can't just send
march in and
say, hey, we're going to take over the investigation. We are the Americans. We know what we're doing. I mean, we don't have a great relationship with Nigeria to begin with. So to think that we can just jump in and tell them we're going to find these girls for you and save the day, it just doesn't work that way.
I mean, one of the more sad parts of the story is the fact that the Nigerian government apparently was very slow to respond, didn't want to take this on because they're getting ready to host a World Economic Forum in Nigeria. And this is the kind of story that makes the government look bad when they're trying to ascend as a power in Africa. Now, by the time we are finally reporting this story and it's getting a lot of attention, it very well may be too late for most of those girls.
True.
But it doesn't mean we shouldn't continue to tell the story, because that problem and the potential. As you said, there have been more kidnappings just this week. We need to shine attention on it to see if anything can be done, at least prospectively.
A story in this week's New Yorker asks, is Laura Logan too toxic to return to CBS? As you'll remember, last fall, 60 Minutes and CBS retracted Logan's flawed report on the Benghazi attacks after it was proven that her main source had lied when described what he claimed was a firsthand account of the attack. Logan spent more than a week defending her reporting, only to later be forced to apologize and take an indefinite leave of absence from the network while it conducted an internal inquiry. Joe Hagan's piece tells a story of a reporter from a well-to-do upbringing who kind of had the world in her hands and would sometimes manipulate it a little bit to get that story. Did we learn anything new about her in this really long New Yorker piece?
I'm not sure whether we learned anything new about her. I think part of the issue here is, and it goes back to something we're going to be talking about in a few minutes, is reporters being stars and not necessarily focusing in on them as being journalists. Mm-hmm. And when they become the story or bigger than the story, then all of a sudden you have these problems. And I think Laura Logan can be used as an example of this, where her personality and her lack of professionalism in some cases, especially when it comes to dealing with sources, came back to hurt CBS in a way that you've seen with Dan Rather previously involving former President George W. Bush during that election and all of those things. I mean, this is something that I think the news media and the executives have to be aware of when they put these people in the spotlight and make them the star and not the news the most important thing.
I think in terms of the public learning anything, it was a very well-written story from my take anyway. And the thing that jumps out at me as somewhat new, at least, is the detail regarding Jeff Fagan, the executive producer of 60 Minutes and head of CBS News, and why he allowed things to happen as they did, the fact that he didn't have the oversight or controls that his predecessor did in making sure these kinds of stories don't get out there and embarrass them. I mean, about Laura Logan, we got a more full picture of who she is. I mean, I do appreciate the fact when she complains that when a male journalist who would do what she did in those dangerous situations would be considered heroic, when she does it, it's foolhardy. On the other hand, she definitely exploited her looks to try to get in with the generals and the other sources, and the fact that she was so tight with some of those sources might have colored her perceptions of the story and led them to be a little less balanced than they should have been.
Okay, well, let's shift gears a bit. I want to talk for a moment about how we cover executions. It's a topic that's top of mind again after last week's unusual execution of Clayton Lockett in Oklahoma. The state of Oklahoma used a new, relatively unproven drug cocktail in last Tuesday's execution, leading to an unexpected result when the drugs were administered. The Tulsa World's Ziva Branstetter was one of the media witnesses. Here she is talking about what made this execution different in her eyes.
The other executions I've covered were relatively seamless. To be honest, they lasted roughly 8 to 10 minutes. The inmates would sort of drift off to sleep. The color would drain from their face. They would make a snoring noise, and that was about it. This is very, very different from any other execution I've witnessed.
Several members of the media appeared really shaken up as they returned back to tell what had happened.
Yes.
Which took more than an hour, and normally it doesn't.
Yeah, there were several media witnesses who had not witnessed an execution before. We were all shaken up. It was very unsettling. He was clearly in pain, but several of them were quite shaken up.
When this story first broke, the headlines read like a bit of a bad joke. Execution halted after prisoner dies of a heart attack. Not exactly clear there that two men were supposed to be executed that night and that there was a stay issued after what happened to Lockett. What's most interesting to me about this story is the differences in how the national and international media covered it compared to some of the Oklahoma newspapers and TV stations, some of the storylines that came out there.
Well, and some of this is just natural. If you're looking at this story from an international or even a national perspective, it really is about the debate over capital punishment and the appropriate methods, if there are such things, for carrying that out. Okay, I get that. At the local level, I think the coverage was much more nuanced and personal. I mean, you heard from the journalists who were witnessing it, and you also heard a lot from family members of the victim of this guy, the guy who went through the heart attack and the suffering. I mean, she was basically tortured, beaten, and then buried alive, you know? And so I understand that you wouldn't focus on those aspects as much in an international or national look at this, but that has a place in the storytelling too, I think.
And I also think part of the story that really needs to be looked at, and it is being looked at on these statewide levels in the states where you do have capital punishment, mm-hmm. where you use the drug cocktail, is the issue of where are they getting the drugs from? And the fact that you have pharmacies now that aren't doing it, you have pharmaceutical companies that aren't producing the drugs that we were using previously in terms of execution.
So which I think is a hot button issue right now in the state of Missouri.
Exactly. And what's happening is that those who are against the death penalty are going after the drug makers and forcing them not to produce the drugs. And now you have states that are running around trying to find drugs wherever they can, and they're not sure what they're getting, and none of it's licensed. And that's creating a serious problem at the state level with those who are saying, we still want to have these executions, find a way to make it happen.
I think the other thing that's really interesting is that, you know, for years now, when there have been executions in death penalty states, there have been witnesses. Sometimes state law mandates it. Sometimes this prison system wants to allow families to be there. Mm-hmm. Journalists sometimes are required or allowed to be there. If the journalists and families had not been there witnessing this, this story would certainly not have taken on the magnitude that it did.
And I think what the public needs to understand is that when you execute someone, you're putting someone to death. There is no easy way around that. You can't, the whole process or the whole thought process of, well, they're going to go to sleep and then they're going to die. It doesn't really work that way. And I think we need to sort of move past that and let the public know when you put someone to death, it is a heinous act. Either by the state or by anyone else.
The next scheduled execution here in Missouri is scheduled for 2 weeks from today. Russell Becklew is scheduled to be executed, like I said, 2 weeks from today for the 1996 murder of Michael Sanders. How do you see the local or statewide coverage either changing or evolving based on what we saw last week in Oklahoma?
I think a lot of it is going to go to what drugs are they using. And whether or not those drugs are going to be able to do the job the way it had been done previously. And if there's any inkling that that's not going to be the case, you're probably going to see a stay of execution. Right?
Okay. Well, there's going to be an item in tomorrow's Vanity Fair written by Monica Lewinsky. After more than a decade of virtual silence, Lewinsky is speaking out about her affair with President Bill Clinton, saying it's time to, quote, burn the beret and bury the blue dress. She also writes that she's had deep regret for what happened, and what did happen was a relationship between two consenting adults. Why now?
I mean, I don't know why now. She says partly it was because of the fact that there never was a perfect time. She delayed telling her story to not affect Hillary Clinton's run for the presidency in 2008.
Which could be happening again in 2016.
Or to affect right. President Obama's reelection campaign. So when's the right time to tell it? She also says she's telling it because she was really impacted by the suicide of Ryan Clemente, the Rutgers student who his roommates taped him having kissing another mm-hmm. man. And so she said, I had my own suicidal thoughts at the time. I'll buy that. I mean, I think those are all potential reasons. You also have all the political prognosticators or the people trying to spin it saying, well, she's going to do damage to Hillary's campaign and she wants to do that, or that Hillary and Bill, you know, coordinated this timing so that the story would be done with before she – I don't care about that part of it. I think that's pretty rank speculation at this point.
I think part of it also may be that, you know, she's trying to craft her own narrative in terms of the history of what happened. I think that's going to be difficult for her because that history is already been written. It's still being written by others, mainly by, you know, presidential historians at this point. So – she may shed some light and add some context to what's being written now, but it's going to be difficult for her to craft that narrative in a way that's
going to tell her own story. It's right. out of her control
yeah, right,
at this
right.
point.
Well, and I have to say, the one thing that I'm sorry to hear her say is that this was sex between two consenting adults. She can say what she wants. She can feel what she wants. But I mean, let's look back at it one more time and take the politics out of it. But here was one of the most powerful people in the world, almost 50 years old, having sex with a 21-year-old college intern. By definition, that's an uneven power relationship, if nothing at all. And what I'm glad is that even though I don't agree with what she's saying, the fact that she's raising this issue at all in the context of all the talk we're having now about sexual harassment in the military or on college campuses, if this will shine a little more light on that relationship between the women who were engaged in sex with generals or football stars. I mean, it's a good thing that we're talking about.
Quickly, before we move on, one of the things that she said is that thanks to Matt Drudge, she was the first person to have their life and reputation destroyed on the internet. Looking at this today, it's not 1998 anymore. Again, talking about the changing media landscape. How might this be different if covered today?
I don't know if it's going to be different. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to see more of it because the media has just exploded, especially when you start talking about digital and online and blogs and that sort of thing. So I think it would have, if you have a similar situation to that today, it would even be blown up even more exponentially.
It'd certainly be snarkier. I mean, you've got to post definitely. A BuzzFeed sort of parody
and,
of all if, of
and
it.
And now you've got the comments. I mean, you right. didn't have the comments.
Commenting then.
Yeah. But I do have to say that I think that if the Drudge Report, back at the time, there were very few media outlets, and Newsweek had this story. Had they done the story, then Matt Drudge might have been a different character today than he is now.
Okay. Saturday night, members of the White House Correspondents Association gathered for its annual gala. The Black Tie event has come to be known as Nerd Prom and brings together journalists, politicians, and celebrities of every ilk, the famous and the infamous. It's the only night you'll find C-SPAN going wall-to-wall with coverage from the red carpet and the 24-hour cable news network stitching reruns of Lockup and Anthony Bourdain to go live on a Saturday night. But for some, the White House Correspondents Dinner is reason to raise an eyebrow. Here's John Oliver in a clip from his new HBO show Last Week Tonight with John Oliver.
Now, Ukraine would have been the talk of the town in Washington all this week if they hadn't spent the whole last 7 days party planning for last night.
The White House Correspondents' Dinner, lovingly called Nerd Prom.
We call it the Nerd Prom.
Nerd this prom. Weekend.
Nerd Prom.
Amazingly, it's actually even worse than it sounds. It is an alarming display of coziness where you can see such majestic sights as National Security Advisor Susan Rice asking for an autograph from the guy from Duck Dynasty. Both of them could justifiably look the other one in the eyes and say, "What the f*** are you doing here?" And they'd both be right. It's a night when journalists celebrate their independence by hanging out with their sources and celebrate their importance by utterly ignoring one another in favour of Hollywood stars. In fact, the main purpose of the evening seems to be providing photos of glamorous celebrities completely unaware of who they are standing next to.
So where do you come down on it? Love it? Hate it? Are we getting too chummy with those recovering?
I think we're getting a little bit too chummy. I remember when it was just the politicians. Now you've got the celebrities showing up, and it's gotten a little crazy.
The only reason I watch it, I have to confess, is to see the president or the comedian who headlines it telling their jokes, but it really says something bad about the disconnect between journalists in Washington and the people that they're trying to report for.
So quickly, you know, Jimmy Buffett always says there's a thin line between Saturday night and Sunday morning. How do you go party Saturday night in an event like this and then go do Meet the Press or something Sunday morning?
It's very difficult. Very difficult.
Journalists are cynical enough. Yeah. They can pull it off.
They can pull it off. Well, there's still so much we wanted to talk about we didn't get to today. You can find more about that on our Links blog, specifically something about whether or not Twitter has died and has become passé. We are out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about. Check out our Links blog under the Programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. It's a great way to watch our program again, see what we'll be talking about next week, leave us comments and questions. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.